This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of One for the Money by Janet Ivanovich, narrated by C.J. Crit. This work, copyrighted 1994 by Janet Ivanovich, is recorded by arrangement with the Aaron Priest Literary Agency. This recording is copyrighted 1995 by Recorded Books Incorporated. In Stephanie Plum's opinion, toxic waste, rabid drivers, armed schizophrenics, heat, humidity, and hydrocarbons are all a part of the adventure of living in New Jersey. But being out of work, and out of money, and having one's car repossessed, is not to be tolerated. And now, One for the Money.
Chapter 1. There are some men who enter a woman's life and screw it up forever. Joseph Morelli did this to me. Not forever, but periodically. Morelli and I were both born and raised in a blue-collar chunk of Trenton called the Burg. Houses were attached and narrow. Yards were small. Cars were American. The people were mostly of Italian descent, with enough Hungarians and Germans thrown in to offset inbreeding. It was a good place to buy calzone or play the numbers. And if you had to live in Trenton anyway, it was an okay place to raise a family. When I was a kid, I didn't ordinarily play with Joseph Morelli. He lived two blocks over and was 2 years older. "Stay away from those Morelli boys," my mother had warned me. "They're wild. I hear stories about the things they do to girls when they get them alone." "What kind of things?" I'd eagerly asked. "You don't want to know," my mother had answered. "Terrible things. Things that aren't nice." From that moment on, I viewed Joseph Morelli with a combination of terror and prurient curiosity that bordered on awe. 2 weeks later, at the age of 6, with quaking knees and a squishy stomach, I followed Morelli into his father's garage on the promise of learning a new game. The Morelli garage hunkered detached and snubbed at the edge of their lot. It was a sorry affair, lit by a single shaft of light filtering through a grime-coated window. Its air was stagnant, smelling of corner must, discarded tires, and jugs of used motor oil. Never destined to house the Morelli cars, the garage served other purposes. Old man Morelli used the garage to take his belt to his sons. His sons used the garage to take their hands to themselves. And Joseph Morelli took me, Stephanie Plum, to the garage to play train. "What's the name of this game?" I'd asked Joseph Morelli. "Choo-choo," he'd said, down on his hands and knees, crawling between my legs, his head trapped under my short pink skirt. "You're the tunnel, and I'm the train." I suppose this tells something about my personality, that I'm not especially good at taking advice, or that I was born with an overload of curiosity. Or maybe it's about rebellion, or boredom, or fate. At any rate, it was a one-shot deal and darn disappointing, since I'd only gotten to be the tunnel, and I'd really wanted to be the train. 10 years later, Joe Morelli was still living two blocks over. He'd grown up big and bad, with eyes like black fire one minute and melt-in-your-mouth chocolate the next. He had an eagle tattooed on his chest, a tight-assed, narrow-hipped swagger, and a reputation for having fast hands and clever fingers. My best friend, Mary Lou Molnar, said she heard Morelli had a tongue like a lizard. "Holy cow," I'd answered. "What's that supposed to mean?" "Just don't let him get you alone and you'll find out. Once he gets you alone, that's it. You're done for." I hadn't seen much of Morelli since the train episode. I supposed he'd enlarged his repertoire of sexual exploitation. I opened my eyes wide and leaned closer to Mary Lou, hoping for the worst. You aren't talking about rape, are you? I'm talking about lust. If he wants you, you're doomed. The guy is irresistible. Aside from being fingered at the age of 6 by you-know-who, I was untouched. I was saving myself for marriage, or at least for college. I'm a virgin, I said, as if this was news. I'm sure he doesn't mess with virgins. He specializes in virgins. The brush of his fingertips turns virgins into slobbering mush. 2 weeks later, Joe Morelli came into the bakery where I worked every day after school. Tasty Pastry on Hamilton. He bought a chocolate chip cannoli, told me he'd join the Navy, and charmed the pants off me 4 minutes after closing, on the floor of Tasty Pastry, behind the case filled with chocolate eclairs. The next time I saw him, I was 3 years older. I was on my way to the mall, driving my father's Buick, when I spotted Morelli, standing in front of Giovicchini's meat market. I gunned the big V8 engine, jumped the curb, and clipped Morelli from behind, bouncing him off the front right fender. I stopped the car and got out to assess the damage. Anything broken? He was sprawled on the pavement, looking at my skirt. My leg. Good, I said. Then I turned on my heel, got into the Buick, and drove to the mall. I attribute the incident to temporary insanity, and in my own defense, I'd like to say I haven't run over anyone since. During winter months, wind ripped up Hamilton Avenue, whining past plate glass windows, banking trash against curbs and storefronts. During summer months, the air sat still and gauzy, leaden with humidity, saturated with hydrocarbons. It shimmered over hot cement and melted road tar. Cicadas buzzed, dumpsters reeked, and a dusty haze hung in perpetuity over softball fields statewide. I figured it was all part of the great adventure of living in New Jersey. This afternoon, I decided to ignore the August buildup of ozone catching me in the back of my throat and go, convertible top down, in my Mazda Miata. The air conditioner was blasting flat out. I was singing along with Paul Simon. My shoulder-length brown hair was whipping around my face in a frenzy of frizz and snarls. My ever-vigilant blue eyes were coolly hidden behind my Oakleys, and my foot rested heavy on the gas pedal. It was Sunday, and I had a date with a pot roast at my parents' house. I stopped for a light and checked my rearview mirror, swearing when I saw Lenny Gruber 2 car lengths back in a tan sedan. I thunked my forehead on the steering wheel. Damn! I'd gone to high school with Gruber. He was a maggot then, and he was a maggot now. Unfortunately, he was a maggot with a just cause. I was behind on my Miata payments, and Gruber worked for the repo company. 6 months ago, when I'd bought the car, I'd been looking good, with a nice apartment and season tickets to the Rangers. And then, bam, I got laid off. No money, no more A1 credit rating. I rechecked the mirror, set my teeth, and yanked up the emergency brake. Lenny was like smoke. When you tried to grab him, he evaporated. So I wasn't about to waste this one last opportunity to bargain. I hauled myself out of my car, apologized to the man caught between us, and stalked back to Gruber. "Stephanie Plum," Gruber said, full of joy and faux surprise. "What a treat!" I leaned 2 hands on the roof and looked through the open window at him. "Lenny, I'm going to my parents' house for dinner. You wouldn't snatch my car while I was at my parents' house, would you? I mean, that would be really low, Lenny." "I'm a pretty low guy, Steph. That's why I've got this neat job. I'm capable of most anything." The light changed, and the driver behind Gruber leaned on his horn. "Maybe we can make a deal. I said to Gruber. Does this deal involve you getting naked? I had a vision of grabbing his nose and twisting it Three Stooges style until he squealed like a pig. Problem was, it'd involve touching him. Better to go with a more restrained approach. Let me keep the car tonight, and I'll drive it to the lot first thing tomorrow morning. No way, Gruber said. You're damn sneaky. I've been chasing after this car for 5 days. So, one more won't matter. I'd expect you to be grateful, you know what I mean? I almost gagged. Forget it. Take the car. In fact, you could take it right now. I'll walk to my parents. Gruber's eyes were locked halfway down my chest. I'm a 36B. Respectable, but far from overwhelming on my 5'7" frame. I was wearing black spandex shorts and an oversized hockey jersey. Not what you would call a seductive outfit, but Lenny was ogling anyway. His smile widened enough to show he was missing a molar. I guess I could wait for tomorrow. After all, we did go to high school together. Uh-huh. It was the best I could do. 5 minutes later, I turned off Hamilton onto Roosevelt. 2 blocks to my parents' house, and I could feel familial obligation sucking at me, pulling me into the heart of the burg. This was a community of extended families. There was safety here, along with love, and stability, and the comfort of ritual. The clock on the dash told me I was 7 minutes late, and the urge to scream told me I was home. I parked at the curb and looked at the narrow 2-story duplex, with its jalousied front porch and aluminum awnings. The plum half was yellow, just as it had been for 40 years, with a brown shingle roof. Snowball bushes flanked either side of the cement stoop, and red geraniums had been evenly spaced the length of the porch. It was basically a flat. Living room in front, dining room in the middle, kitchen at the rear. 3 bedrooms and bath upstairs. It was a small, tidy house crammed with kitchen smells and too much furniture, comfortable with its lot in life. Next door, Mrs. Markowitz, who was living on Social Security and could only afford close-out paint colors, had painted her side lime green. My mother was at the open screen door. "Stephanie," she called. "What are you doing sitting out there in your car? You're late for dinner. You know how your father hates to eat late. The potatoes are getting cold. The pot roast will be dry." Food is important in the burg. The moon revolves around the earth revolves around the sun, and the burg revolves around pot roast. For as long as I can remember, my parents' lives have been controlled by 5-pound pieces of rolled rump done to perfection at 6 o'clock. Grandma Mazur stood 2 feet back from my mother.
"I gotta get me a pair of those," she said, eyeballing my shorts. "I still got pretty good legs, you know."
She raised her skirt and looked down at her knees.
"What do you think? You think I'd look good in them biker things?"
Grandma Mazur had knees like doorknobs. She'd been a beauty in her time, but the years had turned her slack-skinned and spindle-boned. Still, if she wanted to wear biker shorts, I thought she should go for it. The way I saw it, this was one of the many advantages to living in New Jersey. Even old ladies were allowed to look outlandish. My father gave a grunt of disgust from the kitchen, where he was carving up the meat.
"Biker shorts," he muttered, slapping his palm against his forehead.
2 years ago, when Grandpa Mazur's fat-clogged arteries sent him to the big pork roast in the sky, Grandma Mazur had moved in with my parents and had never moved out. My father accepted this with a combination of old-world stoicism and tactless mutterings. I remember him telling me about a dog he'd had as a kid. The story goes that this dog was the ugliest, oldest, most pea-brained dog ever. The dog was incontinent, dribbling urine wherever it went. Its teeth were rotted in its mouth. Its hips were fused solid with arthritis, and huge fatty tumors lumped under its hide. One day, my Grandpa Plum took the dog out behind the garage and shot it. I suspected there were times when my father fantasized a similar ending for my Grandma Mazur. "You should wear a dress," my mother said to me, bringing green beans and creamed pearl onions to the table. 30 years old, and you're still dressing in those teeny bopper outfits. How will you ever catch a nice man like that?" "I don't want a man. I had one, and I didn't like it."
"That's because your husband was a horse's behind," Grandma Mazur said.
I agreed. My ex-husband had been a horse's behind, especially when I'd caught him flagrante delicto on the dining room table with Joyce Barnhart.
"I heard Loretta Buzik's boy is separated from his wife," my mother said. "You remember him? Ronald Buzik?"
I knew where she was heading, and I didn't want to go there. "I'm not going out with Ronald Buzik," I told her. "Don't even think about it."
"So what's wrong with Ronald Buzik?"
Ronald Buzik was a butcher. He was balding, and he was fat. And I suppose I was being a snob about the whole thing, but I found it hard to think in romantic terms about a man who spent his days stuffing giblets up chicken butts. My mother plunged on. "All right, then how about Bernie Kuntz? I saw Bernie Kuntz in the dry cleaners, and he made a point about asking for you. I think he's interested. I could invite him over for coffee and cake." With the way my luck was running, probably my mother had already invited Bernie, and at this very moment he was circling the block popping Tic Tacs. "I don't want to talk about Bernie," I said. "There's something I need to tell you. I have some bad news." I'd been dreading this and had put it off for as long as possible. My mother clapped a hand to her mouth.
"You found a lump in your breast."
No one in our family had ever found a lump in their breast, but my mother was ever watchful. "My breast is fine. The problem is with my job."
"What about your job?"
"I don't have one. I got laid off."
"Laid off?" she said on a sharp inhale. "How could that happen? It was such a good job. You loved that job."
I'd been a discount lingerie buyer for E.E. Martin, and I'd worked in Newark, which isn't exactly the garden spot of the Garden State. In truth, it had been my mother who had loved the job, imagining it to be glamorous, when in reality, I'd mostly haggled over the cost of full-fashion nylon underpants. E.E. Martin wasn't exactly Victoria's Secret.
"I wouldn't worry," my mother said. "There's always work for lingerie buyers."
"There's no work for lingerie buyers, especially ones who worked for E.E. Martin." Having held a salaried position with E.E. Martin made me as appealing as a leper. E.E. Martin had skimped on the palm greasing this winter, and as a result, its mob affiliations were made public. The CEO was indicted for illegal business practices. E.E. Martin sold out to Baldicott Incorporated, and through no fault of my own, I was caught in the house-cleaning sweep. I've been out of work for 6 months.
6 months? And I didn't know? Your own mother didn't know you were out on the streets?
I'm not out on the streets. I've been doing temporary jobs, filing and stuff, and steadily sliding downhill. I was registered with every search firm in the greater Trenton area, and I religiously read the want ads. I wasn't being all that choosy, drawing the line at telephone soliciting and kennel attendant. But my future didn't look great. I was overqualified for entry level, and I lacked experience in management. my father forked another slab of pot roast onto his plate. He'd worked for the post office for 30 years and had opted for early retirement. Now he drove a cab part-time.
"I saw your cousin Vinny yesterday," he said. "He's looking for someone to do filing. You should give him a call."
Just the career move I'd been hoping for. Filing for Vinny. Of all my relatives, Vinny was my least favorite. Vinny was a worm, a sexual lunatic, a dog turd. "What does he pay?" I asked. My father shrugged.
"Gotta be minimum wage."
Wonderful. The perfect position for someone already in the depths of despair. Rotten boss, rotten job, rotten pay. The possibilities for feeling sorry for myself would be endless.
"And the best part is that it's close," my mother said. "You can come home every day for lunch."
I nodded numbly, thinking I'd sooner stick a needle in my eye. Sunlight slanted through the crack in my bedroom curtains. The air conditioning unit in the living room window droned ominously, predicting another scorcher of a morning. And the digital display on my clock radio flashed electric blue numbers, telling me it was 9 o'clock. The day had started without me. I rolled out of bed on a sigh and shuffled into the bathroom. When I was done in the bathroom, I shuffled into the kitchen and stood in front of the refrigerator, hoping the refrigerator fairies had visited during the night. I opened the door and stared at the empty shelves, noting that food hadn't magically cloned itself from the smudges in the butter keeper and the shriveled flotsam at the bottom of the crisper. Half a jar of mayo, a bottle of beer, whole wheat bread covered with blue mold, a head of iceberg lettuce shrink-wrapped in brown slime and plastic, and a box of hamster nuggets stood between me and starvation. I wondered if 9 in the morning was too early to drink beer. Of course, in Moscow, it would be 4 in the afternoon. Good enough. I drank half the beer and grimly approached the living room window. I pulled the curtains and stared down at the parking lot. My Miata was gone. Lenny had hit early. No surprise, but still it lodged painfully in the middle of my throat. I was now an official deadbeat. And if that wasn't depressing enough, I'd weakened halfway through dessert and promised my mother I'd go see Vinny. I dragged myself into the shower and stumbled out a half hour later after an exhausting crying jag. I stuffed myself into pantyhose and a suit and was ready to do my daughterly duty. My hamster, Rex, was still asleep in a soup can in his cage on the kitchen counter. I dropped a few hamster nuggets into his bowl and made some smoochy sounds. Rex opened his black eyes and blinked. He twitched his whiskers, gave a good sniff, and rejected the nuggets. I couldn't blame him. I'd tried them for breakfast yesterday and hadn't been impressed. I locked up the apartment and walked 3 blocks down St. James to Blue Ribbon Used Cars. At the front of the lot was a $500 Nova begging to be bought. Total body rust and countless accidents had left the Nova barely recognizable as a car, much less a Chevy, but Blue Ribbon was willing to trade the beast for my TV and VCR. I threw in my food processor and microwave, and they paid my registration and taxes. I drove the Nova out of the lot and went straight to Vinny. I pulled into a parking space at the corner of Hamilton and Olden, extracted the key from the ignition, and waited for the car to thrash itself off. I said a short prayer not to be spotted by anyone I knew, wrenched the door open, and scuttled the short distance to the storefront office. The blue and white sign over the door read, "Vincent Plum, Bail Bonding Company." In smaller letters, it advertised 24-hour nationwide service, conveniently located between Tender Loving Care Dry Cleaners and Fiorello's Deli. Vincent Plum catered to the family trade: domestic disturbances, disorderlies, auto theft, DWI, and shoplifting. The office was small and generic, consisting of two rooms with cheap walnut paneling on the walls and commercial-grade rust-colored carpet on the floor. A Danish modern couch, upholstered in brown naga hide, pressed against one wall of the reception area, and a black and brown metal desk with a multi-line phone and a computer terminal occupied a far corner. Vinnie's secretary sat behind the desk, her head bent in concentration, picking her way through a stack of files.
Yeah?
I'm Stephanie Plum. I've come to see my cousin, Vinnie.
Stephanie Plum?
Her head came up.
I'm Connie Rosoli. You went to school with my little sister, Tina?
Oh, geez. I hope you don't have to make bail.
I recognized her now. She was an older version of Tina. Thicker in the waist, heavier in the face. She had lots of teased black hair, flawless olive skin, and a 5 o'clock shadow on her upper lip. The only thing I have to make is money, I said to Connie. I hear Vinnie needs someone to do filing.
We just filled that job, and between you and me, you didn't miss anything. It was a crummy job. Paid minimum wage, and you had to spend all day on your knees singing the alphabet song. My feeling is, if you're gonna spend that much time on your knees, you could find something that pays better. You know what I mean?
Last time I was on my knees was 2 years ago. I was looking for a contact lens.
Listen, if you really need a job, why don't you get Vinnie to let you do skip tracing?
There's good money in it.
How much money?
10% of the bond.
Connie pulled a file from her top drawer.
We got this one in yesterday. Bail was set at $100,000, and he didn't show up for a court appearance. If you could find him and bring him in, you'd get $10,000.
I put a hand to the desk to steady myself. $10,000 for finding one guy? What's the catch?
Sometimes they don't want to be found, and they shoot at you. But that hardly ever happens.
Connie leafed through the file.
The guy who came in yesterday is local. Morty Byers started tracking him down, so some of the prelim is already done. You've got pictures and everything.
What happened to Morty Byers?
Busted appendix. Happened at 11:30 last night. He's in St. Francis with a drain in his side and a tube up his nose.
I didn't want to wish Morty Byers any misfortune, but I was starting to get excited about the prospect of stepping into his shoes. The money was tempting, and the job title had a certain cachet. On the other hand, catching fugitives sounded scary, and I was a certifiable coward when it came to risking my body parts.
My guess is, it wouldn't be hard to find this guy, Connie said. You could go talk to his mother. And if it gets hairy, you could back out. What have you got to lose?
Only my life.
I don't know. I don't like the part about the shooting.
Probably it's like driving the turnpike, Connie said.
Probably you get used to it. The way I see it, living in New Jersey is a challenge. What with the toxic waste and the 18-wheelers and the armed schizophrenics? I mean, what's one more lunatic shooting at you?
Pretty much my own philosophy. And the $10,000 was damned appealing. I could pay off my creditors and straighten my life out.
Okay, I said. I'll do it. You have to talk to Vinnie first.
Connie swiveled her chair toward Vinnie's office door.
Hey, Vinnie, she yelled. You got business out here.
Vinnie was 45, 5'7" without his lifts, and had the slim, boneless body of a ferret. He wore pointy-toed shoes, liked pointy-breasted women, and dark-skinned young men, and he drove a Cadillac Seville.
Steph here wants to do some skip tracing, Connie said to Vinnie.
No way. Too dangerous, Vinnie said. Most of my agents used to be in security, and you have to know something about law enforcement.
I can learn about law enforcement, I told him.
Learn about it first, then come back. I need the job now. Not my problem. I figured it was time to get tough. I'll make it your problem, Vinny. I'll have a long talk with Lucille. Lucille was Vinny's wife and the only woman in the burg who didn't know about Vinny's addiction to kinky sex. Lucille had her eyes firmly closed, and it wasn't my place to pry them open. Of course, if she ever asked, that'd be a whole other ball game. You'd blackmail me? Your own cousin? These are desperate times. He turned to Connie. Give her a few civil cases. Stuff that involves telephone work. I want this one, I said, pointing to the file on Connie's desk. I want the $10,000 one. Forget it. It's a murder. I should never have posted bail, but he was from the burg and I felt sorry for his mother. Trust me, you don't need this kind of trouble. I need the money, Vinny. Give me a chance at bringing him in. When hell freezes over, Vinny said. I don't get this guy back. I'm in the hole for $100,000. I'm not sending an amateur after him. Connie rolled her eyes at me. You'd think it was out of his pocket. He's owned by an insurance company. It's no big deal. So give me a week, Vinny, I said. If I don't get him in a week, you can turn it over to someone else. I wouldn't give you a half hour. I took a deep breath and leaned close to Vinny, whispering in his ear. I know about Madame Zaretsky and her whips and chains. I know about the boys. And I know about the duck. He didn't say anything. He just pressed his lips together until they turned white. And I knew I had him. Lucille would throw up if she knew what he did to the duck. Then she'd tell her father, Harry the Hammer. And Harry would cut off Vinny's dick. Who am I looking for? I asked Vinny. Vinny handed me the file. Joseph Morelli. My heart flipped in my chest. I knew Morelli had been involved in a homicide. It had been big news in the burg, and details of the shooting had been splashed across the front page of the Trenton Times. Vice cop kills unarmed man. That had been over a month ago, and other, more important issues, like the exact amount of the lottery, had replaced talk of Morelli. In the absence of more information, I'd assumed the shooting had been in the line of duty. I hadn't realized Morelli had been charged with murder. The reaction wasn't lost to Vinny. From the look on your face, I'd say you know him. I nodded. Sold him a cannoli when I was in high school. Connie grunted. Honey, half of all the women in New Jersey have sold him their cannoli. Chapter 2. I bought a can of soda at Fiorello's and drank while I walked to my car. I slid behind the wheel, popped the top two buttons on my red silk shirt, and stripped off my pantyhose as a concession to the heat. Then I flipped open Morelli's file and studied the photos first. Mugshots from Morelli's booking. A candid picture of him in a brown leather bomber jacket and jeans. And a formal pose in a shirt and tie, obviously clipped from a police publication. He hadn't changed much. A little leaner, perhaps. More bone definition in the face. A few lines at the eyes. A new scar, paper thin, sliced through his right eyebrow, causing his right eyelid to droop ever so slightly. The effect was unsettling, menacing. Morelli had taken advantage of my naivete not once, but twice. After the scene on the bakery floor, he'd never called, never sent me a postcard, never even said goodbye. And the worst part of it all was that I'd wanted him to call. Mary Lou Molnar had been right about Joseph Morelli. He'd been irresistible. History, I told myself. I hadn't seen the man more than 3 or 4 times in the past 11 years, and each time had been at a distance. Morelli was a part of my childhood, and my childish feelings for him had no place in the present. I had a job to do, plain and simple. I wasn't out to avenge old injuries. Finding Morelli had nothing to do with revenge. Finding Morelli had to do with the rent money. Yeah, right. That's why I suddenly had this knot in my stomach. According to the information on the bond contract, Morelli lived in an apartment complex just off Route 1. This seemed like a good place to start looking. I doubted Morelli would be in his apartment, but I could question his neighbors and see if he was picking up his mail. I set the file aside and reluctantly squeezed my feet back into my black heels. I turned the key in the ignition. No response. I gave the dash a hard shot with my fist and let out a grunt of relief when the engine cranked over. 10 minutes later, I pulled into Morelli's parking lot. The buildings were brick, 2-story, utilitarian. Each building had 2 breezeways. 8 apartments opened off each breezeway, 4 up and 4 down. I cut the engine and scanned for apartment numbers. Morelli had a ground-level rear apartment. I sat there for a while, feeling stupid and inept. Suppose Morelli was home. What would I do? Threaten to tell his mother if he didn't come peaceably? The man was up for murder. He had a lot at stake. I couldn't imagine him hurting me, but the possibility of being mortally embarrassed was extremely high. Not that I've ever let a little embarrassment stop me from forging blindly ahead on any number of dumb projects. Like my ill-fated marriage to Dickie Orr, the horses behind. The memory cued an involuntary grimace. Hard to believe I'd actually married a man named Dickie. Okay, I thought, forget about Dickie. This is the Morelli plan. Check out his mailbox and then his apartment. If I got lucky, or unlucky, depending on how you looked at it, and he answered his door, I'd lie through my teeth and leave. Then I'd call the police and let them do the physical stuff. I marched across the blacktop and diligently stared into the bank of mailboxes set into the brick wall. All were stuffed with envelopes. Morelli's was more stuffed than most. I crossed the breezeway and knocked on his door. No answer. Big surprise. I knocked again and waited. Nothing. I walked around to the back of the building and counted off windows. 4 to Morelli and 4 to the apartment behind his. Morelli had his shades down, but I crept close and peeked in anyway, trying to see between the edge of the shade and the interior wall. If the shade suddenly rolled up and a face peered out, I'd wet my pants on the spot. Fortunately, the shades didn't roll up, and unfortunately, I couldn't see anything beyond them. I went back to the breezeway and tried the 3 remaining apartments. 2 were no answers. The 3rd was occupied by an elderly woman who had lived there for 6 years and had never seen Morelli. Dead end. I went back to my car and sat there trying to think what to do next. There was no activity on the grounds, no televisions blaring from open windows, no children riding bikes, no dogs being rude on the lawn. Not the sort of place that drew families, I thought. Not the sort of place neighbors would know neighbors. A sporty car pulled into the lot and swung wide of me, parking in one of the front spaces. The driver sat at the wheel for a while, and I wondered if this was an assignation. Since I had nothing better to do, I waited to see what would happen. After 5 minutes, the driver's door opened, and a man got out and walked to the breezeway next to Morelli's. I couldn't believe my eyes. The guy was Joe's cousin, Mooch Morelli. Mooch undoubtedly had a real name, but I couldn't recall it. As long as I'd known him, he'd been Mooch. He'd lived 1 street over from St. Francis Hospital when he was a kid. used to hang out with Joe all the time. I crossed my fingers and hoped old Mooch was retrieving something Joe had left with the neighbor. Or maybe Mooch was at this very moment jimmying a window to Joe's apartment. I was warming to the idea of Mooch doing breaking and entering when he popped out from behind the building, key in hand, and let himself in through Joe's front door. I held tight, and 10 minutes later Mooch reappeared, carrying a black duffel bag, got into his car, and took off. I waited for him to leave the lot, then I pulled out after him. I kept a couple car lengths behind, driving white-knuckled with my heart drilling hard in my chest, dizzy with the promise of $10,000. I followed Mooch to State Street and watched him pull into a private drive. I circled the block and parked several houses down. At one time, this had been a fashionable neighborhood of huge stone houses and large, well-kept lawns. Back in the 60s, when blockbusting was a popular activity for liberals, one of the State Street homeowners sold out to a black family, and over the course of the next 5 years, the entire white population panicked and left. Poorer families moved in. The houses deteriorated and were subdivided. Yards were neglected. Windows were boarded. But, as is often the case with a desirable location, the neighborhood was now in the process of being reclaimed. Mooch exited the house after a few minutes. When he left, he was alone and without the duffel bag. Oh boy, a lead. What were the chances Joe Morelli was sitting in the house with the duffel bag on his lap? I decided they were fair to middling, probably worth looking into. Now I had two choices. I could call the police right off, or I could go investigate on my own. If I called the police and Morelli wasn't there, I'd look like a dunce, and the police might not be so anxious to come out and help me the second time around. On the other hand, I really didn't want to investigate on my own. Not a good attitude for someone who has recently accepted a job as a fugitive apprehender, but there it was. I stared at the house for a long time, hoping Morelli would come sauntering out, and I wouldn't have to go sauntering in. I checked my watch and thought about food. So far, all I'd had was a bottle of beer for breakfast. I looked back at the house. If I got this over with, I could hit the Golden Arches and squander the loose change in the bottom of my pocketbook on a burger. Motivation. I sucked in some air, shoved my door open, and levered myself out of the car. Just do it, I thought. Don't make a big deal out of something simple. He probably isn't even in there. I strode purposely down the sidewalk, talking to myself as I walked. I reached the house and went in without hesitation. Mailboxes in the vestibule indicated there were 8 apartments. All apartment doors opened off a common stairwell. All mailboxes had names affixed to them with the exception of apartment 201. None of those names were Morelli. For lack of a better plan, I decided to go with the mystery door. Adrenaline tripped into my bloodstream as I turned to the stairs. By the time I reached the second floor landing, my heart was pounding. Stage fright, I told myself. Perfectly normal. I took a few deep breaths and, without benefit of brain, managed to motor myself to the appropriate door. A hand was knocking on the door. Holy cow, it was my hand. I sensed movement behind the door. Someone was inside, looking at me through the security peephole. Morelli? I knew it with a certainty. Air stuck in my lungs, and my pulse throbbed painfully in my throat. Why was I doing this? I was a buyer for cheap lingerie. What did I know about catching murderers? Don't think of him as a murderer, I reasoned. Think of him as a macho jerk. Think of him as the man who led you astray and then wrote the details on the men's room wall at Mario's sub shop. I gnawed on my lip and sent a wobbly smile of hope and insecurity to the person behind the peephole, telling myself no macho jerk could resist coming to the aid of that much guileless stupidity. Another moment passed, and I could almost hear him silently swearing, debating the wisdom of opening the door. I did a little finger wave at the peephole. It was tentative, non-threatening. It told him I was a piece of fluff, and I knew he was there. The bolt slid back, the door was yanked open, and I found myself face to face with Morelli. His stance was passive-aggressive, his voice laced with impatience. What? He was more solid than I'd remembered, more angry. His eyes were more remote, the line of his mouth more cynical. I'd come looking for a boy who might have killed out of passion. I suspected the man standing in front of me would kill with professional detachment. I took a moment to steady my voice, to formulate the lie. I'm looking for Joe Juniac.
You got the wrong apartment. There's no Juniac here.
I feigned confusion, forced a tight smile. Sorry. I took a step backward and was about to bolt down the stairs when recognition hit Morelli.
Jesus Christ, he said. Stephanie Plum?
I was familiar with the tone of voice and the sentiment behind it. My father used that same tone when he caught the Smullins' dog lifting its leg on his hydrangea bush. Fine by me, I told myself. Get it straight from the beginning. There was no love lost between us. That made my job easier. Joseph Morelli, I said. What a surprise. His expression narrowed.
Yeah. Almost as surprising as when you nailed me with your father's car.
In the interest of avoiding confrontation, I felt compelled to explain. I didn't feel obliged to do it convincingly. It was an accident. My foot slipped.
That was no accident. You jumped the goddamn curb and followed me down the sidewalk. You could have killed me.
He leaned beyond the door jamb and looked the length of the hallway.
So what are you really doing here? You read about me in the papers and decide my life wasn't fucked up enough?
My plan evaporated in a rush of pique. I could care less about your fucked-up life, I snapped. I'm working for my cousin Vinny. You're in violation of your bond agreement. Good going, Stephanie. Wonderful control. He grinned.
Vinny sent you to bring me in?
You think that's funny?
Yeah, I do.
And I have to tell you, I really enjoy a good joke these days, because I haven't had much to laugh about lately. I could appreciate his point of view. If I was looking at 20 years to life, I wouldn't be laughing either. We need to talk.
Talk fast. I'm in a hurry.
I figured I had about 40 seconds to convince him to give himself up. Hit him with the heavy stuff right off, I thought. Appeal to his familial guilt. What about your mother?
What about her?
She signed the bond agreement. She's going to be responsible for $100,000. She'll have to mortgage her house. And what will she say to everyone, that her son Joe was too cowardly to stand trial? The contours of his face hardened. You're wasting your time. I have no intention of going back into custody. They'll lock me up and throw away the key, and in the process I stand an excellent chance of getting dead. You know what happens to cops in prison. It's not nice. And if you want to know more of the ugly truth, you'd be the last person I'd let collect the bounty money. You're a lunatic. You ran me over with a goddamn Buick. I've been telling myself I didn't give a hoot about Morelli and his opinion of me, but in all honesty, his animosity hurt. Deep down inside, I'd wanted him to hold a tender feeling for me. I wanted to ask him why he'd never called after he'd seduced me in the bakery. Instead, I yelled at him. You deserve to get run over. Besides, I barely tapped you. The only reason you broke your leg was because you panicked and tripped over your own feet. You're lucky I didn't sue you. You're lucky I didn't put the car into reverse and back over you 3 or 4 times.
Morelli rolled his eyes and threw his hands into the air.
I gotta go. I'd love to stand around and try to understand female logic. Female logic? Excuse me?
Morelli turned from the door, shrugged into a lightweight sports coat, and grabbed the black nylon duffel from the floor.
I've gotta get out of here.
Where are you going? He nudged me aside, shoved an ugly black gun under the waistband of his Levi's, locked his door, and pocketed the key.
None of your business.
Listen, I said, following him down the stairs. I may be new at this apprehension stuff, but I'm not stupid, and I'm not a quitter. I told Vinny I'd bring you in, and that's exactly what I intend to do. You can run if you want, but I'll track you down and find you, and I'll do whatever is necessary to apprehend you.
What a load of bull. I couldn't believe I was saying it. I'd been lucky to find him this first time, and the only way I was ever going to apprehend him was if I stumbled upon him already bound, gagged, and knocked unconscious. Even then, I wasn't sure how far I could drag him.
He left through a back entrance and headed for a late-model car parked close to the building.
Don't bother tracing the plate, he said. The car is borrowed. I'll have a different one an hour from now. And don't waste your energy following me. I'll lose you. I guarantee it.
He dumped the duffel onto the front seat, started to get into the car, and stopped. He turned and straightened, hooked an elbow over the door frame, and for the first time since I'd popped up on his doorstep, he took a few moments to actually look at me. The first rush of angry emotion was gone, and in its place was quiet assessment. This was the cop, I thought. The Morelli I didn't know. The grown-up Morelli, if such an animal existed. Or maybe it was just the old Morelli looking for a new angle.
I like the way you've let your hair go curly, he finally said.
Suits your personality. Lots of energy. Not much control. Sexy as hell.
You know nothing about my personality.
I know about the sexy as hell part.
I felt my face burn. Tactless of you to remind me.
Morelli grinned.
You're right. And you could be right about the Buick business, too. I probably deserve to get run over.
Was that an apology?
No. But you can hold the flashlight next time we play train.
It was almost 1 when I returned to Vinny's office. I slouched in a chair by Connie's desk and tipped my head back to get maximum benefit from the air conditioning.
You been out jogging? Connie asked. I haven't seen that much sweat since Nixon.
My car doesn't have air.
Bummer. How's it going with Morelli? You get any leads?
That's why I'm here. I need help. This capturing stuff isn't as easy as it sounds. I need to talk to someone who's an expert at this job.
I know just the guy. Ranger. His full name is Ricardo Carlos Mañoso. Second-generation Cuban-American. With Special Forces. Works for Vinny now. He makes apprehensions other agents only dream about. He gets a little creative sometimes, but hey, that's the way it is with a genius, right?
Creative?
Doesn't always play by the rules.
Oh.
Like Clint Eastwood in that Dirty Harry movie, Connie said. You don't have a problem with Clint Eastwood, do you?
She punched a number on her speed dial, connected with Mañoso's pager, and left a callback message.
Not to worry, she said, smiling. This guy'll tell you everything you need to know.
An hour later, I sat across from Mañoso in a downtown cafe. His straight black hair was slicked back in a ponytail.
His biceps looked like they'd been carved out of granite and buffed up with armor all. He was around 5'10", with a muscular neck and a don't-mess-with-me body. I placed him in his late 20s. He leaned back and grinned.
So, Connie says I'm supposed to make you into a badass fugitive apprehension agent. She says you need to get the crash course. What's the rush?
You see that brown Nova at the curb? His eyes swivel to the front window.
Uh-huh.
That's my car. He gave an almost imperceptible nod.
So, you need money. Anything else?
Personal reasons.
Bond enforcement is dangerous business. Those personal reasons better be pretty fucking good.
What are your reasons for doing this? He did a palms-up gesture.
It's what I do best.
Good answer, I thought. More eloquent than mine. Maybe someday I'll be good at this, too. Right now my motive is steady employment.
Vinny give you a skip?
Joseph Morelli. He tipped his head back and laughed, and the sound boomed off the walls of the little sandwich shop.
Oh, man! Are you kidding me? You aren't gonna get that dude. This isn't some street punk you're going after. This guy's smart, and he's good. You know what I'm telling you?
Connie says you're good.
There's me, and then there's you. And you aren't ever gonna be as good as me, sweet thing.
At the best of times, my patience was lacking, and this wasn't nearly the best of times. Let me make my position clear to you, I said, leaning forward. I'm out of work. I've had my car repossessed, my refrigerator is empty, I'm going to get kicked out of my apartment, and my feet don't fit in these shoes. I haven't got a lot of energy to waste socializing. Are you going to help me or what? Mignoso grinned.
This is gonna be fun. This here's gonna be like Professor Higgins and Eliza Doolittle does Trenton.
What do I call you? I asked him.
My street name. Ranger.
He reached across the table and took the paperwork I brought. He scanned the bond agreement.
You do anything on this yet? You check out his apartment?
He wasn't there. But I got lucky and found him in an apartment on State Street. I got there just as he was leaving.
And?
He left.
Shit, Ranger said. Didn't anybody tell you that you were supposed to stop him?
I asked him to come to the police station with me, but he said he didn't want to. Another bark of laughter.
I don't suppose you've got a gun.
You think I should get one?
Might be a good idea, he said, still beaming.
He finished reading the bond agreement.
Morelli offed a guy named Ziggy Kulesa. Used his personal piece to put a .45 hydroshock between Ziggy's eyes at close range.
Ranger glanced up at me.
You know anything about guns?
I know I don't like them.
A .45 hydroshock goes in nice and neat. But when it comes out, it makes a hole the size of a potato. You end up with brains all over the place. Ziggy's head probably exploded like an egg in a microwave.
Gee, I'm glad you shared that with me.
His smile lit up the room. I figured you'd want to know.
He tipped back in his chair and folded his arms across his chest.
You know any of the background on this case?
According to the newspaper articles Morty Byers clipped to the bond agreement, the shooting took place late at night a little over a month ago in an apartment building on Shaw. Morelli was off duty and had gone to visit Carmen Sanchez. Morelli claimed Carmen had called him concerning a police matter, that he'd responded, and that when he got to Carmen's apartment, Ziggy Kulesa answered the door and drew on him. Morelli claimed he shot Ziggy in self-defense. Carmen's neighbors told a different story. Several of them rushed into the hall at the sound of gunfire and found Morelli standing over Kulesa with the smoking gun. One of the tenants subdued Morelli until the police arrived. None of the tenants could remember seeing a gun in Ziggy's hand, and the